We're going to go ahead and get started and try to make up some ground from yesterday. We're going to apologize in advance. Oh, excuse me. This will be the second class of the Truth Against the World. Well, first of all, we're going to say we made the comment yesterday that the standards of holiness, and we're going to talk more about holiness in just a moment, is extremely high. The standard is extremely high. Every evening, Stacy and I walk down. We're about a half a mile away from a park and a walking track. And then in that park is a series of baseball fields, softball fields. There's athletics that it's running from the spring all the way till when it gets really cold in the fall. And think about how much energy is spent on those ball fields. All the various parents that think that they're creating the next superstar in sports. But how much energy, how much excruciating energy at times is put into developing the perfect baseball player, the perfect football player. Most of those kids, when they get to high school, they may make the team in high school. Certainly a minute, if almost infinitesimal, number of those individuals will go on and play college sports, and certainly going on to pros is even less than that. But think about the energy that is put into that. And then we talk about the energy that is needed in preparing ourselves for eternal life. Really, the option is very clear. There is no option. So when we talk about the energies that are needed in reaching the requirements that are expected of us in holiness, there's no comparison. There's no comparison. So we don't want to scare people off by talking about the high level of dedication and energy required in achieving holiness. We shouldn't be scared away from it. We should be running towards it with all our might. Now we're going to speak very quickly. We got way behind yesterday, and so that's not to say that what we're talking about is not important. It's just we really want to move on in our subject matter. This was meant to be kind of a foundational, introductory type of class. The mind of worldliness. Why is this so dangerous? To not know the enemy in ourselves, when it talks about the inability to recognize human nature for what it really is. We're not talking about recognizing that men die. We're talking about what makes man tick. Why is it so dangerous to not understand this? To not know the enemy in ourselves and the spirit of this world and how it operates in its deception means that we have lost the battle before it begins. We must know the enemy to defeat the enemy. Otherwise, we judge everything based upon our own feelings and perceptions and embrace things upon our own standards. Is mankind inherently good, or is he something else? We know from the Scriptures that the heart is desperately wicked. We must see this enmity with the flesh for what it really is. It is a warfare. If you consider the service of the tabernacle, as Brother Don is talking about, when you look up, and I should have looked up the passage, but it talks about the service, how long the priests were allowed to serve. If you look up the word that's used there, it is actually not the service of the tabernacle, it's the warfare of the tabernacle. It is a war. It's a war against the flesh. 2 Corinthians 10:4, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. What is our weapon? Hebrews 4:12. For the word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit, and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. The mind of worldliness, deception and apostasy. This has been the great struggle from the very beginning with the lie of the serpent. Thou shalt not surely die that puts sin and death in motion. Adam and Eve's attempts at atonement by using fig leaves. The mud bricks of the Tower of Babel, whose top may reach unto heaven. And Nimrod's setting up of a system of worship around himself. Man's worship of objects made of wood and stone and the apostatizing of first century ecclesia. A continuation of the Nimrodian theology, which we still contend with to this very day. Man's relatively short history has been consumed with rebellion against God's specific requirements, against the simple truths that sin brings forth death, that death is a finality and not a beginning, and the setting up of his own means of worship and comfort. God's ways are not palatable to the thinking of the flesh. Therefore, man has exerted great and continued energy in either changing his requirements or denying his existence altogether. Man wishes to promote his own wisdom, his own ingenuity, and views the doctrines of God as foolishness. It starts small, and it grows from there. Self-determination. Self-determination is to view that we are the masters of our own destiny. Now, we've heard that mentioned already. That life is there for our own enjoyment and our own objectives, and that no one will have the rule over us. If you want it, just take it, or just do it. Hence, the spirit of democracy, which promotes life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or as stated by the French movement, equality, liberty, and fraternity. Cain's descendant, Lamech, exhibited this prideful and defiant spirit in his declaration that it was he who would defend himself against his foes and avenge himself against anyone that would do him harm, leaving God out of the equation. Lack of restraint. Tied to what we have just listed, it is gratification in the here and now, with no real long view of negative consequence or reward. There is no concept of self-sacrifice. And if there is, it is based upon receiving temporal gratification. There is no concept of self-sacrifice. You see all these special causes around the world that are trying to do good for people. And it's always interesting to me when they interview those people on the news, they always say, I feel so much better about myself. It makes me feel good to do this. That's not self-sacrifice. The next one. Envy. Jealousy of others. Desiring, wanting what others have. When we see these people marching through the streets, especially the major push towards socialism in these last days, they call it equality, but it's the fact that they want what other people have. They want what others have. So it's always wanting something more, never satisfied. Narcissism. This is, according to a dictionary definition, means extreme selfishness with a grandiose view of one's own talents and a craving for admiration. A craving for admiration. We can point to many scriptural characters as well as men of common history that display this horrid characteristic of self-centeredness, which results in misery for others. Nimrod being an early example. Now, I may make some people mad, and that's not our intent here. This isn't spoken out of a spirit of judgment, but a spirit of warning nonetheless. But with the rise of social media, the ability for anyone to let loose their cravings for attention and admiration has been made extremely easy. Extremely easy. And you can even read articles. People in the world are even warning about this now. Look at pictures of me. Look at pictures of my beautiful and talented children. Look at pictures of my great vacation. Hey, everyone, don't you know what I'm doing right at this moment? Or what I think about this, or what I think about that? Can't you see how happy I am, how successful I am, etc., etc., etc.? Again, people in the world are figuring this out. I don't know about Christadelphians. Write a letter, write an email, call somebody up on the phone. Self-centeredness Such is to love the praise of man more than the praise of God. Loving the praise of man more than the praise of God. Humanism. The epitome of worldliness. It is an outlook or system of thought attaching prime importance to human rather than divine or supernatural matters. Humanist beliefs stress the potential value and goodness of human beings, emphasize common human needs, and seek solely rational ways of solving human problems. This is even more dangerous when it is blended with religion. The modern manifestation of this is the Catholic and evangelical systems, a theology of humanism, if you will. A lot more could be said about that, but we're going to keep rolling. Political correctness. This is avoiding language that might offend anyone. That's the definition. Words do matter. Words do matter. And though it should never be our objective to offend others, it should never be our objective to offend others. We also know that if we speak the truth, that truth by its very nature is offensive to those who do not want to hear the truth, as it is painful to the thinking of the flesh. Therefore, political correctness as a practice is an insidious tool of worldliness. Sometimes language or reference to truth or an honest expression of what someone believes is avoided altogether out of fear of the offense it may cause or criticisms that it may cause to the speaker. That is why it's often just important to pay attention to what speaking doesn't, or what a speaker doesn't say, as to what they are saying. We live in a world where it is the common philosophy to neutralize truth rather than to declare it openly. Brethren, we have political correctness within Christadelphia today. And finally, and again, you could probably add to this list, take away from this list. These are just thoughts that we have had over the years. And finally, and Brother Don has been talking about this and mentioned at great length yesterday, is the idea of discontent or murmuring. Discontent and murmuring. It starts small and then it builds from there. Dissatisfaction with natural things, dissatisfaction with spiritual things. Now we move on to holiness, and our goal is to get to theistic evolution today, and we're going to get there. Holiness, in Galatians 5, we also read starting in the 22nd verse. We read of the works of the flesh, but we also read of the fruits of the Spirit. Starting in the 22nd verse, that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance, or self-control. Against such there is no law. And they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and lust. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not be desirous of vain glory, provoking one another, envying one another. Under the law, the high priest was to wear a plate of gold on his forehead, symbolizing that which was to be on the forefront of his mind, inscribed with the words, Holiness unto Yahweh. In Leviticus 11:44, we read that the children of Israel were thus commanded, For I am the Lord your God, or Yahweh your Elohim. Ye shall therefore sanctify yourselves, and ye shall be holy, for I am holy. Holy, the word holy, a commonly misunderstood word, is from the Hebrew kodesh, to be set apart. Now we ask the question, set apart from what and for what? All that is touched or influenced by sin's flesh, that which is not of the Father, is what we are to separate from. To be set apart, justification is required by connection with Christ's shed blood. Our unclean sin nature receives atonement or covering, and past transgressions are forgiven. We are therefore set apart from sin. And though we still live with the flesh or the sin flesh nature, having been covered but not yet cured with the future gift of eternal life, we are not to be subject to sin. And Romans chapter 6 really goes into great detail in that, as well as 1 John chapter 3 and verse 3. In Deuteronomy 18 and 19, thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God. Perfect here means to be devoted or single-hearted. What is it that we are to be devoted to, single-hearted towards? What is our ultimate motivation? As we read in Matthew 6 yesterday, it is to seek first the kingdom of God. Hebrews 11 informs us that Abraham looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Holiness, separateness, is to be truly set apart and single-hearted towards the righteousness of God, and it involves a total commitment to the hope of Israel. If this condition is met, there is no room for worldliness in its various manifestations. Service to God is the highest objective, not academic, athletic, professional achievement. And it must be remembered that Christ is our primary example of holiness unto Yahweh. The mindset of holiness. Again, this could be added to, it could be further expanded, but this is just a brief overview. The fear of Yahweh. In Psalms 111, verses 7 through 10, we're told this: the works of His hands are verity and judgment. All His commandments are sure. They stand fast forever and ever and are done in truth and uprightness. He sent redemption unto His people. He hath commanded His covenant forever. Holy and reverend, or to be feared, is His name. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do His commandments. His praise endureth forever. God is not a friend, as the church world has tried to reduce Him to. They've also tried to reduce the meaning of what it means to fear Yahweh, that it's just a reverence. Well, that's partly true in the definition, but it is truly a fear, understanding God's infinite power versus the fact that we are nothing more than dust and ashes. It is a fear. With that, and these are truly compatible concepts, is the love of Yahweh, and by extension, those that are His. Matthew 22 and 37. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it: thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. How do we demonstrate such a love? If you love me, keep my commandments. This is a big one. Not that the others are not, but this gets abused. Gratitude. In teaching students in the public schools, gratitude is really, it's interesting to see how this is evaporated from the culture. It is a concept that is very difficult to fully manifest in this age of plenty and of those overcome with the spirit of Laodiceanism and need of nothing. With the great expanse of this universe, what is man that God is mindful of him? In the belly of the sea creature, Jonah exclaimed in his hour of dire need, in Jonah chapter 2 and 9, I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that I have vowed. We ask the question, why, Jonah? He answers, because salvation is of Yahweh. Salvation is of Yahweh. How grateful are we to Him in whom we live, move, and have our being. How grateful are we? Circumcision of heart. This is a cutting off of the impulses emanating from the sin flesh nature. Romans 2 and 29. He is a Jew which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God. circumcision of the heart. Understanding that the path to the kingdom is not a wide road, and the majority cannot be followed to find it. As Christ emphatically states in Matthew 7:15, because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. What do we see among the household in modern times but a overt, not a covert, but an overt and forceful move to expand the way, to increase, to enlarge, to not be so strict, not so exclusive, not so structured. A stranger and pilgrim in both mindset and action. As David proclaimed, the king of Israel, he himself proclaimed this in Psalm 39 and 12. I am a stranger with thee, and a sojourner, as all my fathers were. Can we truthfully, if you're honest with yourselves, can we truthfully claim the same for ourselves regarding this fact? Are we really strangers and pilgrims? Love not the world, neither be in a position where the world loves us. Let me repeat that. Love not the world, neither be in a position where the world loves us. Let's go to John 15 and 19. It's important to look this up. I don't want to skip over this. If you were of the world would love his own. But because you are not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. That was immediately spoken to the apostles, but it was also extended to others that would follow. Instead of a self-serving and narcissistic way of life, we are to be a living sacrifice to God. That's Romans chapter 12 and 1. A living sacrifice. Complete devotion to the truth in word and in deed, in its promotion, defense, and practice. Complete devotion to the truth in word and deed. So when we talk about this principle of holiness, I hope I didn't steer it in the wrong way with some of our opening comments. It has to do with what we believe, what we profess, as well as how we act it out. Complete devotion to the truth in word and in deed. In its promotion, its defense, and its practice. We have to remember that it is truth, it is always truth against the world. Many passages that we could look up in this, and we are not going to at this time. Meekness and humility. The previously mentioned characteristics, especially fear, love, and gratitude, if properly applied, should result in these critical attributes. As Abraham understood, we must realize that we are nothing more than dust and ashes. If we are to glory in anything, it is to glory in the Lord. If we are to be bold in anything, it is to in the certainty of God's promises. This should be the easiest of concepts to grasp, but yet, the pride of life is one of the most difficult of things for us to tame on a daily basis. A daily basis. And it manifests itself in some of the most inopportune times as well. And sometimes in ways that we don't recognize until after the fact. Now, make no mistake about it, it is truly an extraordinarily high standard that even at our best, we still fall short of. We must give all that we have of ourselves. Finding ways to do the least we can do is not part of the deal. Finding ways to do the least. Shortcuts are not allowed. Shortcuts are not provided us. But we have to consider how high the stakes truly are. it is truly a matter of life and death to us. And as we feel very strongly that is this issue of worldliness versus holiness that has created a great deal of difficulties for us in these last days as far as the household is concerned. Now we move on. One last thought was, and it's already been talked about this week already, is to Philippians 4 and 8, to think on these things, to think on the things of righteousness, to meditate upon the things that will help counter those things of the world. Theistic evolution. Billy Graham, I came across this. It really actually surprised me. Billy Graham tends to be from a church standpoint of view, a very conservative leader among the evangelical movement. But in 1966, he had this to say. Kind of left it just for you to decide. Either at a certain moment in evolution, God breathed into one particular ape man, who was Adam, or God could have taken a handful of dust and created a man just like that. Those were Billy Graham's thoughts in 1966. Kind of left it, the creation of man kind of as a... God either did this or he did that. It doesn't really matter. Now, it is not our intent in this class to scientifically disprove the theory of evolution. That's not our purpose. As the subject itself is quite expansive, and a great deal of time and energy can be devoted to addressing all of the examples found in science itself that reveal the sheer impossibility and preposterous nature of the concept. What is of more immediate concern for us is in this consideration is the attempt by some who call themselves Christadelphians to adapt something known to the world as theistic evolution, which attempts to combine a belief in God with the concept of evolutionary theory. But as we will consider, there is absolutely no compatibility between these two diametrically opposed positions. There is no compatibility between our understanding of creation as revealed to us in the Scriptures and the concept, a horribly false one, of theistic evolution. Now, in a recent phone conversation with a brother, an older brother, on the East Coast, he relayed to me a recent conversation that he had had with a young unamended brother who was bemoaning the fact that he was one of the few Christadelphian young people that he knew, and in his part of the country, he was the only Christadelphian young person that he knew that did not believe in evolution. Now, we cannot present this conversation as a hard and factual statistic as to the spread of the acceptance of evolution in Christadelphian circles. It is only an anecdotal in nature. So take that for what it's worth. But it certainly got our attention. We do know that theistic evolutionists, under the name of Christadelphians, have taught at North American Bible schools. And we are also aware of extensive Christadelphian social media conversations that have rejected the biblical account as nothing more than an allegory and have promoted evolutionary theory as the explanation for creation. Matter of fact, the seeds of looking at Genesis as an allegory, or a metaphor in some cases, goes back decades within Christadelphian circles. And what's interesting about these theistic evolutionists that are promoting their wares through social media is that unless you hold a degree in various related sciences, as do some of these proponents, you are not allowed to approach these self-appointed experts to debate the matter. You're not educated in science, we don't want to talk to you. You're too stupid to understand what we're talking about. Considering the already widespread and growing acceptance of Darwinian theory around the world, even among those who consider themselves to be religious, it should be no surprise to us as to the very real threat that such theories are posing to the hearts and minds of Christadelphia. young and old alike, but especially the young people. Science, education, the Western culture at large, and even major religious institutions now treat evolution as a fact. But it is important to ask the obvious first. What is evolution? It is the theory that life on Earth was not created, but developed gradually over time. For the most basic of cell structures, by an accidental convergence of biological building blocks, that once life came into being by that first amoeba-type organism that over the course of millions of years, through external influences of nature, climate change, mutations in biological structure, and the need for survival to changing circumstances, that life grew into more complex organisms and into varied species such as animal life and vegetation, perfectly balanced on an earthbound ecosystem that is perfectly independent upon one another for survival. That is evolution in a nutshell. And we're going to skip over this, but it's a quote from Brother Thomas out of the opening section, page 1 of Elpis Israel. A very, very beautiful statement by Brother Thomas regarding the creation of the earth. Now, the evolutionary formula is as follows. Evolution equals matter plus evolutionary factors, which include chance and necessity, mutation, selection, isolation, and then death, plus very long time periods. God does not fit into this equation. The basis of this theory is that the concept of a creator being responsible for our existence is itself an impossibility and a myth. Now keep this in mind as we transition to considering theistic evolution. Keep this in mind. That's why all of you know this, but that's why we're leading into this. Looking at it from a matter of the odds of life coming into being on its own, along with the perfect conditions of the earth to support life, its perfect distance from the sun, the perfect gravitational balance of our galaxy, the infinite wonders of our visible and invisible universe, it is irrational to conceive that a creative force is not behind all that exists. It is irrational. But if God is completely denied, it is argued that evolution is the only rational explanation, as the odds are irrelevant. It doesn't matter what the odds are. There is no God, so evolution is the only explanation. It becomes a rather circular argument, as the premise of evolutionary theory is that God does not exist. It is interesting to note, though, that some scientists deny the existence of God, while at the same time conceding, understanding the complexity of everything, they concede that life on Earth did not happen by accident. What is their solution to the problem? That life came here from aliens. That's their solution. I think Richard Dawkins, I think he's one of the premier evolutionary proponents, and that's his solution to the matter. Let's go to Psalm 53 and 1. I should have this written down, but Isaiah 53 and 1. The scriptures take quite an opposite view of these things. Again, first principles, we read in Psalms 53:1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Hebrews 11 and 6. Hebrews 11 and 6. But without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. And Isaiah 45. Isaiah 45, verses 5 through 8. I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Let's go ahead and drop down to the 18th verse. For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God Himself that formed the earth and made it, He hath established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Now either we believe that or we don't. We either believe it or we do not believe it. There isn't a way to bridge that gap. We either accept these simple and fundamental facts or we do not. If we truly believe what God has revealed about Himself, there is no further room for confusion and certainly no room for debate. Man continually spends vast amounts of money, time, and energy theorizing about the origins of the earth and life upon it, changing his views on a continual basis. He changes his views on a continual basis with so-called new evidences and better theories, even claiming that the answer to our origins is on desolate planets, such as Mars or on comets. We need to be looking for our origins out there somewhere. While man stretches the limits of human knowledge for answers, he refuses to refer to the most widely published and distributed book in the world. A book that provides all the answers we need in very straightforward and simple terms. Of course, the Bible. Their refusal to rely on its record is an irony of the most grand and tragic of scales, but such is their folly. As big of a problem the theory of evolution has been in undermining faith in the existence of God and acceptance of the complete authority of the Bible, we sense a bigger problem has been the attempts among Christians so-called, and also Christadelphians so-called, to try to claim that both evolutionary science and Christianity both have merit, and that Christian belief can be adapted to evolutionary theory. This is known as theistic evolution. Now, theistic evolution, looks like I got behind there. Theistic evolution is the teaching that God used natural evolutionary processes to bring life to its current level of speciation. Theistic evolution would deny the specific creative act of God in bringing the person of Adam, who would be the first human and the representative of mankind, into existence. So the theistic evolution would deny the specific creative act of God forming man out of the dust of the ground and breathing into his nostrils the breath of life. They would deny that fact. Now there are, in discussions with brothers already this week, there are variations of how they try to explain Adam and what follows after. There's differences in that. So you have to be aware of that. And I don't really have any interest in getting into any of that. Theistic evolution is the same formula as what we see in evolution, except they add a plus God. They'll add God to the equation. God was kind of set things in motion, a little push here, a little shove here, but let this whole process work over time. For some people, that may sound reasonable. Problem is, it doesn't work with the scriptural record. Now, this is highly interesting to me, is that the roots of theistic evolution. What are the roots of this blended view that God or some higher power exists, but that He has used the evolutionary process to bring these things where they are now? The Jesuit priest Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, I don't speak French, a Jesuit priest, same Jesuits that gave us the alternative views of the apocalypse, the same system that has given us a total and absolute apostate system of worship that leads men into death, they also gave us theistic evolution. He lived in the first half, this individual lived in the first half of the 20th century. and is credited with blending the theory of evolution with the biblical account into what is called theistic evolution. In his book, The Phenomenon of Man, posthumously published in the 1950s. He had a background in paleontology and evolutionary theory. It is interesting that the Catholic Church hierarchy were at first very opposed to his ideas. They were very opposed to his ideas. But in more recent years, he has received praise from the former Pope Benedict and other prominent Catholic Church officials. We remember when Pope John II endorsed the theory of evolution as a reasonable explanation of creation. For centuries, the Catholic Church has sought to suppress scriptural teaching as church tradition was thought to supersede the Bible, with the Pope being declared infallible in 1870. So it makes sense that the Catholic Church would have no qualms in accepting evolution as it undermines those in the Protestant movement who view the Bible as the only authority in divine matters. The Catholic Church does not care about undermining the authority of the Scriptures because it gets in their way. And this would include the creation of the earth and man. This is from Wikipedia. A lot of revealing thoughts in this. The phenomena of man sets forth a sweeping account of the unfolding of the cosmos and the evolution of matter to humanity, to ultimately a reunion with Christ. In the book, Chardin abandoned literal interpretations of creation in the book of Genesis in favor of allegorical and theological interpretations. The unfolding of the material cosmos is described from primordial particles to the development of life, human beings and the newosphere, and finally to his vision of something he calls the Omega Point in the future, which is pulling all creation towards it. He was a leading proponent of orthogenesis, the idea that evolution occurs in a directional, goal-driven way, argued in terms that today go under the banner of convergent evolution. A lot of fancy terms here. Teilhard argued in Darwinian terms with respect to biology and supported the synthetic model of evolution. Teilhard made a total commitment to the evolutionary process in the 1920s as the core of his spirituality, at a time when other religious thinkers felt evolutionary thinking challenged the structure of conventional Christian faith. Now this guy's a hero. Teilhard makes sense of the universe by its evolutionary process. He interprets complexity as the access of evolution of matter into a geosphere, a biosphere, into consciousness in man, and then to supreme consciousness, what he calls the Omega Point. Teilhard's unique relationship to both paleontology and Catholicism allowed him to develop a highly progressive cosmic theology which takes into account his evolutionary studies. Teilhard, and please note this, and brother, we hear this in the Brotherhood today, not just on this issue, but other issues. Teilhard recognized the importance of bringing the church into the modern world and approached evolution as a way of providing ontological meaning for Christianity, particularly creation theology. For Teilhard, evolution was the natural landscape where the history of salvation is situated. I'm looking at ontological. I put it down. I accidentally deleted it and put it incorrect, but the little star that I have at the bottom, it shouldn't be ontological. I had to look that up. It's a philosophical study of the nature of being. That's what ontological or ontologicology means. It's a philosophical study of the nature of being. So what exactly does theistic evolution involve? The basic principle, evolution itself is taken for granted. It is believed that evolution is a universal principle known as uniformitarianism, which contends that the same natural laws and processes that operate now have always been in operation in the universe, and that what we observe in the present is the key to the past. That's why they would say the Grand Canyon took millions of years to develop, because these processes have always worked at the same length of time, and it's taken millions and millions of years for these processes to work out. Now, this would discount major earth-altering events such as the flood. It also affects how science looks at geological dating. A lot of problems with geological dating. So young people don't, if you hear these in your classes or science classes or whatever, it's not set science. And they discount the fact that events such as the flood can greatly alter how geological dates can be assessed. Water changes a lot of things. Evolution relies on processes that allow increases in organization from the simple to the complex, from non-life to life, and from lower to higher forms of life. The driving forces, as we've already considered, of evolution are mutation, selection, isolation. We could go on there. The time is so long and vast that as much time as is desired can be used to justify the process of evolution. Millions of years, billions of years. They believe the present, observing what we see now, is the key to the past. For those who believe in the Word of God, we understand that that's not the case. They believe that evolution will persist into the distant future. Theistic evolution adds to this evolutionary foundation. They believe that God used evolution as a means of creating. They believe the Bible contains no usable or relevant ideas which can be applied in present-day origins science. The Bible's worthless when it comes to talking about our origins. This is theistic evolutionists, by the way. Evolutionists' pronouncement have priority over biblical statements. So if you're a theistic evolution, you have to believe science first, what science says, and then try to modify it according to the Scriptures. But evolution has the priority. The Bible must be reinterpreted when and wherever it contradicts the present evolutionary worldview. This is theistic evolution. The failures of theistic evolution. Now, before we get there, does this seem reasonable to us? The scientific world and much of the world itself has bought into the continued and pressing claims that evolution theory is not merely a theory, but the very fact of life itself. Layers and layers of geological history, fossils, carbon dating, DNA, all of these have been interpreted, and that's the key word. They have been interpreted by science to mean only one thing, that the idea that God creates the heavens and earth as recorded in Genesis is nothing more than a myth. At the same time, the so-called Christian religions of the world understand that there are spiritual things that are unexplainable apart from a belief in God. But yet they are intimidated and sold on the idea that these two contradicting principles must somehow be reconciled with one another if Christianity is to survive. But in order to reconcile the belief in God with evolutionary theory is deemed as taking priority as the ultimate authority, and critical portions of the Bible are deemed as irrelevant. It must be understood that Genesis chapter 1, and quite frankly, the first three chapters of Genesis, are the foundation stone of all that follows, to the very last chapter of Revelation. If you either take away the first three chapters of Genesis, and actually more, and deem this as only a myth or allegory, the entire credibility of the Scriptures as an actual record to the existence and revealed will of God falls to the ground. The rest of the Scriptures cannot survive without those first three chapters. Our understanding of truth cannot be an understanding of truth without an understanding of those first three chapters. The proponents of theistic evolution have to know this. They know it. Desiring to insert their own cosmological view of the God in the universe without use of the Bible, they're inventing a new form of religion. So, as we will see, there is no middle ground between evolutionary theory and an uncompromising acceptance of the Word of God as the supreme and only authority of man's history and future. There are problems with theistic evolution, apart from the problems with evolutionary theory. Huge, huge problems. And we'll go through those tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.